This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.
Hello, and welcome to our special podcast episode, which discusses Silicon Valley Bank and its collapse. What were the causes and what we can learn from it? My name is Jackie Barrett, and I am a partner at Hall & Wilcox and the head of the US desk. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank has been reported far and wide, and while it has already had a significant impact on global markets, the full ramifications of its collapse remain to be seen. Today, we are very fortunate to be joined by Jason Schneiderman, who is a partner at Silicon Valley-based law firm Perkins Coie, a recognized Am Law 50 firm in the United States. Jason is a Silicon Valley startup attorney and has had a very interesting week. And he's in the midst of helping clients deal with the fallout from Silicon Valley Bank. We'd love to hear more about, I suppose, that the last week and your experience of that journey, if you'd like to share, Jason.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me start just, I'll tell just a teeny bit more about myself just to kind of give some context of what I do and sort of my long history in Silicon Valley. So born and raised here, I'm a second generation startup lawyer. There's not many of us. I think I can count them on one hand. So I've been around entrepreneurs my whole life. And I also even worked at a startup before I entered into the legal career over 19 years ago. And so and what I work is, again, with people who have ideas and entrepreneurs and growing these high-tech businesses that you kind of hear about. And so I know we're here to talk about Silicon Valley Bank. And so I want to give you just a little bit of context. I'm not going to kind of go into when they were established and all that other kind of stuff, but it's important to kind of understand how they kind of fit into the startup ecosystem. So, as you kind of know, startups generally try to seek funding from venture capitalists. And usually it could be at a very beginning stage when they just have an idea, or maybe they have some revenue or whatnot, but they'll typically go to what we would call Sand Hill Road or to the VCs and raise funds. As part of that process, they're sort of built up Silicon Valley Bank, which became sort of the institution that the funds would be deposited in, or that they could actually get venture lending from. And so as part of maybe you raised $5 million, they could also kind of go get some additional funding from venture, from Silicon Valley Bank in the form of a loan. So maybe they'd raise another $1 million, maybe on a line of credit or just a loan. And then Silicon Valley Bank would typically sort of take some sort of sweetener with that, like a warrant. And what made Silicon Valley so unique than other banks is other banks wouldn't lend to startups because they had no history or runway, maybe no revenue. Their financials weren't like what you would typically think of an ongoing business. And so Silicon Valley Bank played this crucial role of sort of being a lender that would give to these startups. And again, they would take these sweeteners, and sometimes it would work out quite well for Silicon Valley Bank because their warrants would turn into a real upside on the value. So that was kind of generally the proposition that Silicon Valley Bank was kind of going after with these venture loans, servicing this community that was underserviced. They're having a strong relationship with the VCs on Sand Hill Road. And it was sort of this symbiotic system. As you kind of roll that forward over the years, they kept growing. Silicon Valley kept growing. Startups kept growing. A lot of money kept coming into the space. And so the bank grew. And so they were lending out more money to various startups. And that was all, kind of in the ordinary course of business. But again, it was one of these sort of unique lenders that you don't sort of see that would give to startups, that would work with startups. There's a few others in Silicon Valley, but they were the best, the most predominantly known. I think I heard or I saw a statistic, just before they collapsed, that they had roughly bank accounts with 50% of the startups that had been formed in the last 5 years. So they were the bank of half the startups that got funded by VCs. So that just kind of let that sink in a little bit, is that these high risk businesses with maybe no revenue that are very tied into the ecosystem, they made up 50% of that market. You might have heard in the news in the last couple of years with the pandemic, there was all these PPP loans. An enormous amount of money was distributed out from the government to various companies, and the startups were a predominant source of receiving these funds. So, and also in the last couple of years, there was a lot of money raised for venture capitalists to deploy out with other startups. And so there was just a ton of liquidity in the market. And then Silicon Valley Bank was the receiver of a lot of those funds. So I think in the last 3 years, their deposits grew from something around like 60 to 70 billion to 170 billion, a 3x growth in a very short period of time, which is hard for any institution or a bank like that to kind of manage the money that just comes in very quickly. And so that's part of the problem, is there's all this money that kind of came in. And then they put those investments into very stable, long-term US treasuries. And so banks, typically what they do is when they get their deposits, they build sort of a book around those investments to make sure that the bank is stable. Well, what we've been told is that interest rates climbed, what we saw, interest claim rates climbed very quickly. And yeah. So those long-term investments they had to have a write-down. And so they went to basically the market to sell them, take a write-down on their books and put them into more short terms with better interest rates. And that caused, at the end of the day, about $1.8 billion write-down on their books. So overall, that sort of spooked the shareholder side of things, because the communication probably coming out of Silicon Valley Bank could have been better. But there was this write-down on this $1.8 billion. There was questions about the stability of the company. And so the stock price plummeted. Then what you see there, people started to get concerned about their deposits with the bank when they see a drop in the stock price. And you had some very well-known VCs tweeting out to their portfolios of 100 clients or so saying, hey, we think Silicon Valley Bank's weak. You should take your funds out. And that was kind of basically the spark that caused the run. And so this is probably the first real true sort of social media like connected run on the bank. And so within basically 3 to 5 hours, you had an enormous amount of people withdrawing funds. I think at the end of the day, on the first day, they withdrew something close to $48 to $50 billion. And at the end of it, they had $1 billion left in deposits that they could support. So it was really clear that they were probably going to have people come the next day to withdraw more funds. They wouldn't have the amount to cover the deposit. And that's why the FDIC stepped in. Well, actually, it was first sort of the state regulatory bank and then the FDIC, but they stepped in and basically stopped trading on the stock. They stopped and held deposits and took over the bank.
Right. And so just coming back to that run on the bank, they did attempt a capital raise, didn't they, after they made that sell down of the securities?
That's exactly
what
right.
What was it that was not, what I mean, it spooked the market, but what about that capital raise wasn't attractive to the existing shareholders or prospective investors?
Yeah. I mean, it was basically that failure for them to kind of cover that capital raise, that $1.8 billion or so, or whatever they were raised, that basically had the stock plummet. And really, I don't quite know what it was that caused that fundraising to fail, other than, you know, probably some very key investors looking at what Silicon Valley's made up of, which is startups, which are high risk businesses. And they say to themselves, well, look, Silicon Valley Bank has 50% of the startups and they're very high risk businesses. And all of a sudden they want to raise money and they have a write down of $1.8 billion. And this is all a very risky investment. There's probably better places to put our funds than into trying to buy shares in Silicon Valley Bank at these high prices. And then once they failed to make that fundraise, that's really when you saw the shares price plummet. And that's when you really saw people say, oh my gosh, this bank is going to go under. But at that point in time, they actually still had plenty of money to cover deposits. So there wasn't that part of it. It was just really the value on stock on the stock exchange that really spooked folks. But when I sort of say spooked folks, the key people I think that's going to kind of come out after they really do this forensic on it are going to be some of these key venture capitalists that basically, you know, went out to their portfolios or you know, tweeted that like, hey, Silicon Valley Bank's not doing well. Might have meaning like and not doing well on the stock market, it plummeted there, but like it didn't really mean that they had bad assets on the books. It didn't really mean that they couldn't cover the deposits. But you know, everyone started to withdraw and they basically said, take your money out, it transferred to other banks. And that really, you know, you can do that on a phone now, right? You can transfer all your money like for the luxury of your phone, no matter where you are in the world. And that was basically the spark that kind of just, and so at one point it was just irrational to do it, but as hour two or three and everyone was making a run on the bank, it was irrational not to take your money out because because you didn't want to be the last people in, right? It was your classic run on the bank.
Yeah. I mean, it is incredible. And for you, I think making that observation about the impact of social media on that situation, it's quite, I think that there's another whole issue to unpack in that regard in terms of, you know, sort of what was appropriate conduct. But it's so fascinating from, I suppose, just a social studies perspective to see how that impact of social media, being able to tweet out your concern, not perhaps sufficient explanation, but that triggers enough worry and panic that it leads to a run on the bank. It's just quite incredible to think about that it would have that much impact.
Yeah.
Just to come back to one of the things you said, Jason, around the focus, I suppose, that or their target market for Silicon Valley Bank, do you think that one of the contributing factors would be the potentially the lack of diversity in its customer base? Would it have been better for it to have a better spread of clients as opposed to this focus on startups to give them that certainty and depth? Would that, do you think that might have helped?
Yeah, I do. I think when some, you know, business school analyst pulls this all apart, that is absolutely going to be one of the factors. So I believe one of the statistics is that something like 80% of the deposits were above or weren't insured by FDIC. So the federal bank or the federal government, basically FDIC insurance, will insure up to $250,000. So, and usually most sort of regional banks or other banks, they have a lot of depositors like you and I or small businesses. Mm. And usually they have a higher percentage of people that have deposits that are covered by the $250,000 level. Yes. Silicon Valley Bank on the other side of it, had lots of deposits that were well over the $250,000, more so than any kind of other normal bank that you would hear about. And so it was that, I think that's one aspect that when investors were freaking out and they figured it out, was one issue of concern, right? Like if this bank's going to go under, we have all, like you probably hear these stories, which is true. Like I had a client that had all their money, $16 million in that bank, in one bank, right? Which they had just raised from a venture fund, right? So that is very typical of sort of their asset portfolio was 16 million bucks, 250,000 insured by the government and the rest not. And so they had a high percentage of it. I think the percentage is 80% of their accounts were like that.
Yeah. And that those high deposits, reflection of capital raising, reflection of government grants, those that sort of funding. And so a lot of the startups would have had a big pool of funds vulnerable and exposed in the bank.
Yeah. And the other part that's sort of we should probably get into a little bit later is it's not just that they had deposits there, but again, going back to they made a lot of loans or lines of credits with these startups. And a lot of these startups relied upon that for payroll or for growth or you know, equipment purchases and things like that. And now all of a sudden they're freaking out. They don't have access to it. And so the big question kind of on Wednesday and Thursday is, should I pull all those money out if I can and breach my financial covenants? And should I move everything out of Silicon Valley Bank? Because one of the main terms when Silicon Valley Bank lends the money, they say, okay, I will give you $1 million, but you have to have all your accounts with us, which goes right to like that account concentration issue. So a big topic going forward is going to be pushing back on lending firms like Silicon Valley Bank or that say you have to have all your funds with us. They're going to say, can we diversify across three banks? So that will be something that gets talked about and negotiated. We're doing another line of credit with a different bank right now. And one of the things we're pushing on is the covenant that we have to have all our money with them, pointing out exactly this problem that happened with Silicon Valley Bank. So they are open to discussions on it at the moment.
Wow. And you've pointed out a number of, I suppose, unique aspects of Silicon Valley Bank in the way it worked. But is there anything else that was unique or special that would have been attractive to a startup or a tech founder in terms of their dealings? Did they lend on different terms? Were there different arrangements that you wouldn't typically see in a normal bank?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, they usually do these sweeteners, like these warrant coverage. So you would lend on $1 million and then they would ask for 1 or 2% of the company on a warrant. And so that was sort of the sweetener. So it's the upside for them. So that's one unique factor. Another one is just, you know, and it's sort of a negative connotation, but like the cozy relationship with the venture capitalist is a very unique relationship. So 19 years ago, kind of when I started practicing, the lawyers actually, I had a direct contact with some VP at Silicon Valley Bank to open up an account for our startup. So when our startup said, hey, who do you know at Silicon Valley? I say, we'll call Bob or Mary. Roll the clock forward. I was just kind of convention with the partner a couple years ago saying like, you know, I don't really have a relationship with them anymore. Like, I don't know who to send it to. And I think it's because the VCs really wanted to be the ones that made the introductions. And so I'm not saying excluding out the lawyers caused this problem, but what I'm saying is that when you kind of funnel all the relationship, or not all of it, but like a predominant amount of the relationships via the VCs and that kind of relationship, you just create sort of a symbiotic relationship there. And so part of it is venture capital is risky. And now you have sort of this relationship with the VCs and the bank, and you're kind of adding risk upon risk. But it also is kind of, to me, it was sort of a little bit indicative of how general banks work. So I grew up with three things that my father told me. You want to have a good banker, a good butcher, and a good barber, right? And so you want to have a great relationship with your banker. I remember going into the bank with my dad and knowing the vice president and seeing him, and he knew who I was just as a kid, right?
Yeah.
You don't have that. You don't have that anymore. Or at least we didn't with Silicon Valley Bank. When I started as an associate, I did, but as a partner, I couldn't tell you who to call. My partners know the people on the board members. So that's who we were calling, when this was going down, but I couldn't tell you, I don't think there was a relationship with my clients and like a VP of the bank for them to call up and say, hey, everything's okay. Your accounts are okay. This is what happened. We took a $1.8 billion write down on deposits. We have plenty of money. You know, there just wasn't that kind of like calming voice that someone could reach out to, or sort of like the outreach on it anymore, that like those direct relationships that I could think of, right? Like they called me like, who can I talk to at Silicon Valley Bank to get my money out? I'm like, I don't know. Who did you work with? Like, I don't know. It's all online, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, so, that's a lesson that could be learned globally, really, Jason. Like if I reflect on the Australian banks, there, you know, it is now because technology is first and foremost, the convenience and the flexibility, and we all love that. I'm in the same boat as your clients. I wouldn't know who would be the right person to call should there be an issue. It probably raises a question for banks in terms of, you know, to what extent they can communicate with the market and provide reassurance. They have the overlay, you know, of being a listed entity. And so that in itself, I imagine, creates complexity on that front.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just one factor. It's just an observation I have. I mean, like, you know, and it's wonderful. Everyone references Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life about the bank run there. But in that one, he literally had a relationship with all those people in the town. He knew who they were. He could assure them that their money was safe because he was like, it's in so-and-so's house. It's in whatever, you know, if you remember watching the movie, you know, there's, you know, you just don't have those relationships with bankers anymore. So one of the things that you kind of worry about is maybe there's a broader risk with banks because of just how fast social media and all this, and how quickly with a click of a button, you can move money around.
Well, yes. How quickly people can transact.
Yeah.
Because I mean, look, and there've been bank runs in the past and at times when technology wasn't a factor, but they could just lock their doors. And now technology liberates you in a sense, and you can have that access and that capability to move money very quickly and large amounts of money. So it may, as you say, it may have implications later for when there is the examination and the scrutinization of what's happened. You know, there may be more rules and regulations put in place around, you know, ability to move funds, what to do in a scenario where there may be a run on the bank, those sorts of things. It could get very interesting. Do you think, Jason, with this issue occurring for Silicon Valley Bank, that it will change the way venture funds operate? Or how will it impact, do you think, the startup community, at least in the short term, in terms of how they can find funding and then who are they going to be dealing with for banking purposes?
Yeah. So I think, you know, time will tell. But if I kind of had to speculate a bit, I think in the next month or two, the VCs are now re-looking at their portfolio companies and making sure, you know, what they were doing on Friday, Saturday, Sunday was looking at them and making sure they could cover payroll or not.
Yeah.
That got solved by the government basically backing 100% of the deposits. So for the most part, that issue kind of has gone away at the moment. I put an asterisk on that just because, again, people had lines of credits and loans, and those. And so I think what the VCs are looking at their companies are like, hey, how much were they dependent on these loans with Silicon Valley Bank to actually fund the business and payroll? And do we have to now step in with our own money to cover that or not? And then is there some companies now that are on the chopping block because they don't want to take on that risk or not? Because they offloaded it to Silicon Valley Bank.
Yes.
So you're going to see a few businesses go by the wayside just because of how kind of leveraged they were with Silicon Valley Bank and the VCs not willing to kind of step in. So I think that's one thing that's kind of getting assessed this week and the next couple. And so usually when VCs do assessments, they sort of pull the plug a little bit on new investments until they figure out how much of the dry powder they have to support their current portfolio. So we saw that when the pandemic hit, they kind of stopped for a bit and took a pause and went through their portfolio. We saw that kind of with these high interest rates, they kind of took a pause. And we were in Silicon Valley feeling that December, January, February is sort of interest rates were kind of ratcheting up and the portfolio companies were sort of looking at how much did they raise and were the LPs trying to push back on the size of the funds and so there was just some assessment already kind of going on before this hit. And so next month or two, you'll see that. And then kind of in the broader thing is there's a hole like Silicon Valley Bank provided the bank that startups could go to because they were high risk. And there's a few other people that fill that gap. As I said, Silicon Valley take 50% of that market. So there are other banks out there, but are they going to be less inclined to take on these startups? Possibly, right? Or want to or at least limit their portfolio of how many they do take on. So there is this. So the good news is there'll probably be some bank that wants to come in and roll the dice with these startups, because there could be quite a bit nice upside on these like warrants and things like that. And there was also a lot of really good startups that were doing quite well and had a lot of money. So it's a pretty lucrative space. But I think it sort of needs to, everyone at these banks are going to kind of think through, do I jump in or do we move away from these high risk sort of startups and go back to something more conservative? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do know this from living in Silicon Valley. Given enough time, people will forget. And when they see opportunities, they will dive in and take on a lot more risk.
Yeah. And I mean that entrepreneurial spirit will shine through, I would imagine, longer term. In terms of the international implications of this, do you have any sort of thinking on how this might impact other markets or ways that we should work differently to avoid something like this?
Yeah, I don't have any concrete numbers on the international aspects of SVB, but let me kind of speculate a little bit with you. So what was interesting, the banker I knew, he used to be, focused on Silicon Valley, but he was now tasked with focusing on startup ecosystem in the Middle East. And that was kind of like where Silicon Valley Bank was kind of looking to expand relationships in the Middle East. You see them in India, you see them in the UK. And so they had this really kind of game plan to kind of expand internationally. And what they were trying to tap into was, all these countries or even various states in the United States or cities are trying to create their own little Silicon Valleys, right? And Silicon Valley Bank was kind of there in those ecosystems to kind of provide that service, fill that void or be part of sort of the, if you see VCs going there, we'll bring Silicon Valley Bank along, right? And or Silicon Valley Bank target those. So I think with sort of like in the UK, I think is a good example, I think HBSC or whatever that bank is, took over the Silicon Valley Bank UK portion of it, right? And so I think there's going to be sort of ramifications around risk and that aspect in the UK. But to your question, like on a broader sort of psychological aspect, I do think so, because I think these ecosystems that are trying to create entrepreneurial high-risk sort of startup, they're now missing a bank that was willing to work with them. Just to kind of give you an example, I have a couple clients in the Middle East, and the only bank that they could get an account with was Silicon Valley Bank.
Right.
That was the only one, because they were a startup. They just raised, half a million or so from angel investors. No other bank wanted to touch them, not even an Egyptian bank or not even in Turkish bank.
So you don't have that benefit of a high risk appetite in that market anymore.
Yeah.
I suppose on that note, if we think of it along those lines, it could mean significant changes for the way we see startups raising capital. We see venture funds operating, their source of funds, obviously, but also just if you don't have that supporting financial institution that's willing to take that risk, it could significantly, and perhaps this is a bit bold, but it could significantly impact or reduce the funds that might be available to support these startups in terms of their growth.
Yeah. So what's also super interesting is when I was a lot younger, you could account the venture capitalist on, like, there's maybe a dozen. You could count on one. There's something like 1,600 venture capitalists now, I think, is the last number I saw. They come and go over the years. They up increase, but there's still a handful, maybe, 20 to 30 that write big checks and raise billion-dollar funds and that are credible. There's some people raise money, but I wouldn't say they're credible. But there's still, a small subset. Going forward without kind of like Silicon Valley Bank, my sense is maybe the fundraise that the client has to do has to be higher.
Right? Yeah.
And that means that you're tapping into those venture capitalists who raise the billion-dollar funds versus all these little sort of smaller VCs that raised, $20 to $30 million. And because their $2 or $3 million check just isn't going to cut it and granted, they probably wouldn't have gotten too much access to debt if they're only raising $2 or $3 million. But, there's just, usually people sort of flight to sort of the big players. You're going to see a concentration in the banking system to the big ones for stability, right? It's sort of probably the same mentality is going to happen a bit in the VC world when it comes to LPs, the people that actually fund the venture capitalist, more inclined to go with the bigger funds than like your Andreessen Horowitz's or your Sequoia's or whatever, versus going for a mom and pop venture fund, right? Just because, again, flight to stability, flight to, too big to fail, like flight to with more resources. And again, probably making up the gap that Silicon Valley Bank, was kind of offloading some of that risk. So the other thing that might actually happen, like historically, so I was talking to my father. My father is like probably literally the first startup lawyer in Silicon Valley. And he was the attorney that formed this company called Linear Technology. It's an analog chip company. And he was mentioning that their first fundraise was $600,000. So maybe with interest inflated, because my dad's a little old, talking about $3 million these days.
Yeah.
And they were worried about the risk. So they kind of shopped it around Sand Hill. There was only a dozen people, but they kind of took, $100,000 from one and $100,000 from another. So they got like six investors in to kind of, spread the risk on it. And you would typically see that with many deals is like, two or three funds would kind of come in. Over the last few years, I've seen a little bit more concentration where one fund just wants to take it all or not spread the risk as much. But I think you're going to kind of go back to that mentality of sort of spreading risk across more VC funds in the short term here. And so I think that's going to be one where you have the VC network's going to kind of lean on each other to spread the risk. There's going to be more analysis on it when you're looking at the investment. But I think that might happen, in the short term, is if there's a void, is like, okay, let's spread the risk across more VC funds versus partnering up with like Silicon Valley Bank or something similar to that.
And Jason, in your experience, so what's the history of VC funds kind of collaborating like that? Would that be a totally new development?
From day one, they were all pretty chummy group on Sand Hill Road, and they all kind of, shared, the risk
took a
and
share.
They kind of source stuff. And there's like some maybe a little bit competitive rivalry here and there, but as sort of time went by and you have this sort of explosion of funds, there was sometimes a pretty darn fight to get into a company. And then you want to take it all because you think it's the winning horse. When I was sort of practicing early, 19 years ago, like usually my deals had like two or three funds. If they were like a high quality venture fund, it was like kind of split between two or three funds. I still have that, but I just say I've noticed it a little bit less over the last 5 years or so. I have like kind of a lead that's willing to take, the whole chunk or they take such a big aspect of it, like maybe $2 or $3 million. Like if it's a 10 million round, maybe they only allow two or three to come in. It's not really spreading risk, but maybe they're bringing some people for their thought leadership in a space.
Yeah. And in terms of the startups you've worked with, what's their appetite been for that? So they've been quite open to having that diverse mix of VC investment.
Well, if you bring the right people to the table, like, and that's the really important thing, is that if the VCs also want to kind of have smart people and well-connected people, in the investment to kind of leverage. And so that is one of the crucial factors that they kind of bring into it, other than sort of risk offsetting. I mean, it is risk offsetting. Like if you bring in a well-known VC that understands SaaS, and then you bring another one that understands AI, and the startup you're investing in is SaaS/AI, and maybe you can throw in another thing, it's all related to insurance. Then you bring another VC that knows insurance. Well, now you got three VCs around the table that kind of know their sectors, and you can kind of bring them all together and sort of de-risk kind of like, you know, market fit kind of questions for the founders and help them in that sense. So there's a lot of thought and strategy around that.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the next couple of weeks, do you see there being much action, or is it all now just hinging on what the government inquiry will be, and that you'll say that it really things have settled down to the extent that there is obviously the government support for the bank in the short term?
Yeah, as I said, the payroll stuff is mostly settled, other than the companies that kind of relying on their line of credits or loans. And so I think that's going to trickle through for a good 3 to 6 months, and you'll see sort of weird stuff popping up. You know, the regulatory aspect and kind of the Fed and the state regulatory and the reviews they're going to do and the politicians, you know, pointing fingers at one or another, that's going to go on for, unfortunately, a year or two.
Yeah.
You might see some new regs in a year, but like our Congress is so dysfunctional that it's like next to impossible to have like a good solution get through.
Yes.
So that's kind of like on that side of it. But from a Silicon Valley kind of ecosystem point of view, there's a couple of things that are sort of interesting. Yeah, this is going to have an impact. People were already uneasy. But we're also seeing a lot of tech layoffs. So Meta just announced another 10,000 layoffs. What's interesting is for the beginning parts of a startup in the startup ecosystem, it's actually a good thing, because usually some of the best startups you ever see happen in a recession, or when a lot of these tech folks get laid off, they turn into entrepreneurs, and then we start forming a lot of companies around them. And then, you know, usually in the next, you know, 3 to 4 months, we'll form a bunch of companies. They'll work in the quote unquote, the garage on whatever their project is for another 2 to 3 months as they get a pilot, raise a couple $100,000. And then hopefully we're kind of, you know, in full swing with a bunch of brand new sort of startups that are really sort of attacking the ecosystem and getting venture funding come, you know, 2024 with bigger checks. So I'm an optimistic person.
I was going to say, it's like quite an exciting environment to be operating in. So they've got this incubator situation happening, lots of new ideas, lots of new innovation. That sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
And it's quite fascinating. I think it's a unique aspect of Silicon Valley environment that you're describing, Jason, in terms of that ecosystem revival.
Yeah, yeah. Like I'll leave with one example. And so I have this one founder, kind of a think tank coming out of a sort of a lab at a university, super smart, like very technical oriented, not very business. One person was laid off at one of these big companies, sort of tech, but slash got good management skills in business, has sort of a bit of an entrepreneurial skill. They met on a playground because their kids were there, hit it off, and now they got a new company. I hope that's the next big thing, because it's kind of this, and right now everyone's talking about artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff. And
yes,
it's kind of in that vein. So, and they're smart, two smart people, one now that kind of has the business savvy slash know how to sort of build and manage something, and one that really has a deep understanding of the technology that's probably going to have a nice market fit. I have a feeling in 2 or 3 months, after they kind of build out the beta better, they're going to be off the races, raising a good amount of money, if not sooner, because they're kind of in like the hot market. So that's just kind of like, you know, there's a rinse and repeat cycle that just happens in Silicon Valley, which, you know, everyone's trying to kind of get that same ecosystem going in other places. With Silicon Valley Bank missing, maybe aspects will be harder, but entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs, and there is something in the water here about starting new companies. And so, you know, damn the torpedoes, no bank or bank, they will probably make something go of it. So
I'm
generally optimistic.
That's very reassuring, Jason. We're really happy to hear that. I'm interested. The fact that the federal government stepped in to guarantee all deposits, Jason, I mean, that's obviously not something that we ought to do every time there's something, an issue with the bank. And already they're talking about Credit Suisse having issues, and it's kind of, I suppose, drawn a lot of attention to that over the last week. But what do you think the implications are of that, that the fact that they stepped in to do this? A lot of the media in Australia has talked about why did they step in to support it? Such high deposits, like these are some of these startups are worth billions of dollars themselves. Like, why why single them out to support it? And I think from, you know, I'm not a banker either, but my basic understanding, of course, would cause a run on the banks across the US. And so it would have triggered a financial nightmare and equivalent to what happened in 2008. Yeah. But it's just a question of, well, you know, when the next crisis hits, what do we think the federal government will be in a position to do? I suppose it certainly interests me from being an outsider in the from the US market. What, like, why is it they chose to do it? And what does that mean for the future in terms of the government's role in banks?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one that everyone's kind of asking, the same ones, like, because so there's this mentality out there, like, you know, let it burn. Like, they messed up. Like, nope. Like, we should not save them. Let it burn. And so there's definitely people on Capitol Hill with that mentality of, like, let it burn. The problem is, I mean, thank goodness the Fed didn't take that position, because the repercussions for losing this bank, or even sort of Signal Bank, would have just, you know, been far reaching. And partly, I think what the Fed is doing is what Congress can't do anymore, and which is really sad, is, like, if it was a functioning Congress, they could probably have solved it in maybe a different way, or sort of helped, but they delegated all this power to the Fed. So one of it, the Fed's like, well, we've got to save the day. So we have a broad mandate. So we'll do that. And part of it is just bringing stability to the banking system. So we're just going to leverage it. They'll deal with the repercussions from the Congress people saying too much money. At the moment, there was $100 billion or plus or so in FDIC insured accounts. So, like, it really is not coming out of the taxpayers' pocket.
Yeah.
You know, it's coming out of, like, customers to the bank's pocket, but it's not coming out of taxpayers. So the people on Capitol Hill aren't going to hear so much from people, you know, like, you know, taxpayers saying, why did you bail them out? Because they didn't take a hit. But if we have another big bank, there's no more insurance. And so then now they have to go to Congress and say, you need to give us more money to solve it. And I don't know if they have, like, the political will to kind of, you know, stop the crazies out there saying, let it burn.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. Like, now we've created a system where banks will, and me is like, well, look, I can take on a lot more risk because the government's going to bail me out.
Bank will step in. Yeah.
Yeah. And people will say, look, I will take on a higher risk, you know, instrument, because the US government's going to come bail me out, which is a wrong mentality. But I think that is one thing that needs to get solved. So that's why you probably will see some additional regulations coming out of Congress or recommendations at the end of the year. And then the other thing too, I think, is going to get, for, you know, a slap on the hands, or pretty hard slap on the hands, is the state regulators really, like, why did they not catch this sooner? And so there's going to be a little bit of extra pressure on that short term,
like, the fact it happened so quickly, because when we were researching this, Jason, we, you know, Forbes declared them the fifth best bank in America in February.
Yeah.
And then a month later, we have a situation where they've collapsed. And so it does make you wonder what was going on. And it can't just be, I mean, surely it can't just have been a product of one failed capital raise. It's very concerning. But then it probably plays back into what you said at the beginning of this podcast around the impact of social media, the easy spread of information and communication, and the associated, I think, and that's probably a reflection, I think you could probably apply this across the board to all industries, but the way that social media operates is, or at least, again, I'm not an expert, but my perception being that, you know, someone making a claim who may not actually have any basis for making that claim can make that claim with confidence, and then people will take that up and run with it. And so it is a pretty scary environment to operate in when you think, like, the influence that those social media operators can have in terms of managing this sort of situation. It's terrifying.
It totally is, you know. And I was kind of talking with my dad, and, you know, and I was like, God, in the old days, you know, the VCs would have called each other, like, called the bank, and talked to each other, and, like, you know, they would have said, hey, what's going on? What's the reality here? They would never have, like, gone out, take all your money out of Silicon Valley Bank. Let's, you know, put it in the dustbin in a day. They would never have done that. But with this sort of newer generation and newer capital and the speed and the social media.
As you said before, you kind of initially they were saying you'd be crazy to do it, but then when everyone else was doing it, you'd be crazy not to do it. And so that pace and speed with which transactions and things are happening, these are all things I think that need to be reflected on when, you know, in terms of the post-mortem of Silicon Valley Bank, to see, because, you know, in the future, how will a bank or another financial institution be able to replicate what Silicon Valley Bank has done? Doesn't sound like it will necessarily be possible.
It uniquely grew with the whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
And then the one thing, though, there's a couple of interesting things that I think to watch is that Silicon Valley Bank is sitting on these warrants. Yeah, they have a ton of warrants with all these startups. And I don't know how you value it or not, but the auction of those warrants will be an interesting indication of if they have actually things of value or not.
And Jason, just for the benefit, I suppose, of the Australian audience, what do you mean by a warrant? Is that like a mortgage?
No. So what it is, it's like a stock option in the company. It's a right to purchase shares in the future
at a
set price. Yeah. So what they'll basically say is you'll give me 2% of the business and I have a strike price at maybe your last preferred financing round of like $2. So if you have a liquidity event or go public, then I'll exercise. But if you go belly up, then I'm not out any money.
Right. Okay. And so you could have, when the liquidator comes in, they will look to perhaps exercise those options.
Yeah. Yeah. So
take an interest.
Or sell them off. So that's, so because the warrants are sort of usually for 5 to 7 years. And so let me give you, I don't know, what's a high flying startup that's just kind of new, but I don't know, like ABC crypto company, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They have a warrant there for 2% of the business, right? And maybe it gets diluted down to like 0.5%, but let's say it has a liquidity event for $1 billion where all of a sudden there's a half percent of $1 billion that they got just as a sweetener for doing loans with them. And so they probably have 1,000+ of these various companies' warrants, probably more than that, probably like 2,000 or 3,000 types of company warrants just sitting in their asset books. I don't know if they're worthless or they could be the next golden ticket. I mean, if you had a warrant, they may have in Google, but that could have been worth billions.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Wow. And that is, I suppose, that would be a unique feature of SVB.
Yeah.
To have this warrant. Yeah, it's not something you would necessarily have received from in a more conventional banking environment that they would have negotiated.
They just want securities. They want to know they get paid back, and then they have all these finance. But Silicon Valley Bank, they're like, great, high risk, give us some extra sweeteners. So when you have a exit, we make a bunch of money.
Oh, incredible. Just incredible. Thank you, Jason, for joining us today. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. As always, please get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can find our details on our website, which is www.hallandwilcox.com.au or perkinscooey.com, or connect with us on LinkedIn. If you enjoyed today's episode, please feel free to rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, Jason.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.